This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey, listener, it's your host, Nick, here with a quick message before the show. If you enjoy this episode, learn something new, or just feel like helping us out, please consider following the show, subscribing on your favorite podcast platform, leaving us a 5-star review, or sharing this episode. All of these things greatly help the Birdshot Podcast and allow us to reach more and more listeners just like yourself. I would appreciate you taking just a minute to do any of those things. And if you really love the show and you want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, subscribing, and following, you could consider becoming a Patreon contributor, which gets you some exclusive discounts and promotions, some bonus content from time to time. You'd be eligible for any and all Patreon giveaways. And last but hopefully not least, I will send you some Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you from me for your support of the show. You can learn more and sign up for that at patreon.com/birdshot or click the link in the show notes to this episode. Thank you very much for listening. And with that said, I hope you enjoy this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. And we're back on the Birdshot Podcast. I'm joined here by my, gosh, it's going to be a longtime friend now, Mr. Coyle. How you doing, Keith?
I'm doing very good, thanks. And absolute pleasure to be back with you on the podcast. I think this is number 3, isn't it? Or number 4?
I think it's actually 4.
Yeah. And if you listen closely to behind, I don't know if you can hear it, but that's the sound of thousands of cotton wool pads being opened, because your listeners know that at some point their ears will begin to bleed.
Yes, they're recognizing that familiar voice at this point.
Good stuff.
It's been a couple of years since we've had you on the show. I think last time I was down at your old shooting grounds. You got a new one now. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. I had an 8-year contract, obviously, working at Green Acres, and completed that. Achieved everything, you know, was asked to do and more. But obviously, the shooting instruction and the gun fitting is truly, truly my core profession. And I really just, don't get me wrong, running game shoot days and brilliant, it's great fun. But the shoot school, it's really what I wanted to do. And I had the opportunity to move on. My good friend David Brewer offered me the chance to use a parcel of land on his farm. And had a very nice lodge on it, which I'm very pleased to say. It's where he used to live in his younger days, if you like. He's moved into the big house now, his mum and dad are gone. But, I'm very pleased. It's not without its problems. But, of course, as I say, it's what I want to do. It's great ground. And I'm back doing what I really love to do. And, I'm very, very lucky. So, yeah. And now, of course... Had the first couple of months of this year to reorganise, obviously going independent now. You know, I've now got the opportunity, I'm starting to advertise myself, you know, the shooting school, which I really wasn't truly able to do before. So we've gone down that route. And thanks, of course, to yourself and Dan and the UGC. You know, I've got clients coming in already. So there you go. Thanks very much.
Yeah, that is great to hear, and that is one of the ways that you and I do keep in contact, as sort of a steady stream of Upland Gun Company customers headed your way to do those gun fittings. And yeah, we're for listeners that are familiar with where you were before at Green Acres, where are you now located, just to give people an idea?
Okay, well, the shooting school is located in the town of Pontiac, and that is actually about another 45 minutes further north from Greenacres. So I'm really closer now to the outer suburbs of Chicago. And pretty much, if people know the geography and the roads, the school is almost set equidistant between the I-55 on the west and the I-57 on the east. It's literally, equidistant. It's very nice location. One of the big benefits I've got is that I'm using a part of the farm which doesn't create revenue from any form of agriculture. So to a degree, it's very good for the farm. I'm using up land that they weren't previously using. I'm right out in the middle of nowhere in a sense that I don't have suburban areas around me. So when I'm actually in what I call the shooting area, where we go after we do the gunfits, I've got a whole range of traps out there. And the great thing is, I've got a 360 degree, if you like, rotation around all of those traps. So we don't have to have a vast area, we don't have to have 15 stations or anything like that. And it just works brilliantly. It is a shooting school, it's not a shooting ground, but I can still throw any combination of targets. We've got standards, middies, rabbits, battues. I've got two wobble traps, for instance. And David's invented this ingenious frame that he now puts on his telly boom. And there's another separate part of the ground which is perfect. It backs onto to a river. It's got trees and undulations, and there's one spot now which is just the perfect location for me to teach high-driven targets. So I've really got everything within just a very small area. And as I say, it's private. There's no one around. There's no one observing. When we're out there, it's just. Just you or myself and the client. It's yeah, I'm pretty happy about it. As you, it's pretty happy about the whole thing.
Excellent. Yeah, well, it sounds like a fun place to go and get some efficiency. You're not moving around a huge grounds. You can sort of get a lot done in a small area, right?
Yeah, it's got all the trimmings. I've got a very nice coaching area. Oh, sorry, fitting area inside the clubhouse, got everything I need. And you walk out the clubhouse and then 30 seconds walk, we're at the it's the pattern plate area, which is nicely tucked out the way. And then from there, when after we have, we go out to the what I call the coaching area, we just jump in the Kabuto. 30 seconds, I'm at the coaching area. And it's just it's just ideal. It for me, a lot of people don't truly understand this, but as you know, I used to my apprenticeship with is Roger Silcox at his shooting ground in Somerset many years ago, and it was called the Roses Wood Shooting School. And for me now, this is my Roses Wood. This was always a pinnacle that I was always aiming for, and I'm very grateful because I could never have done it in England. I would never have been able to afford the ground and get the permission in the UK truly to do what I do here in the US. So very fortunate, and I'm glad I'm here.
Well, we're lucky to have you.
Now, let me congratulate you very quickly before we go on, because I understand you had a brilliant show at the Pheasant Fest in Kansas. If I'm not mistaken, heard through the
There
jungle
was,
drums.
yeah, it was.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I mean, everybody that I get through, and yeah, I get lots of people, lots of, I like to think lots of people, not just your clients. But without doubt, the UGC clients, firstly, I don't know how you manage to sell guns to such nice people. They're all nice people, mate, they come along.
Well, we love to hear that.
And of course, you're keeping the enthusiasm that you generate in these people about their guns is just fantastic. Good job, chaps. Keep doing it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, I like to think that's sort of evident in how much fun we all have sort of doing this process and building the business really over the last few years, and we're obviously working very closely with the Italian manufacturer RFM, and we're kind of a conduit of sorts for our customers to work with the gun maker, and that's a fun process. I think people get excited about it, and that's evident when they come to see you.
I mean, it I think, as we've said before, from my point of view, what you are doing, and I'm not going to say not other gun manufacturers are doing it, but you particularly, you're maintaining the history, without, if you like, I mean, here there is a far greater interest in side by sides. In the UK, it's not such a vast market, but here the enthusiasm for side by sides is keeping the history and the essence of what shotgunning was about. And I think, as you know, that the history of the shotgun, I mean, why it was invented, as the saying says, necessity is the mother of all invention. The reason why the shotgun was invented, and this might come as a surprise to some, was that it purely came about for the English and Central European aristocracy of the 18th and 19th century to have a more efficient way to shoot driven pheasants. And that's it. That's why a shotgun was invented, not for no other reason than that. It didn't really, it wasn't until after the Well, post-Civil War here in America, that of course the shotgun was developed for other things, the old guy on the stagecoach, protecting, and they were cutting the barrels down and so on. But shotguns purely were invented for the aristocracy to enjoy their sport. And of course it goes back to that old, what Chris told me, the saying is, what's a shotgun? Clever idea by a simple man. He was walking through the field one day, and of course he sees a rabbit, and he points his finger at the rabbit, and he walks along a bit more, sees the big wood pigeon fly out the trees. As I said, always good eating. And of course he points at the pigeon. He goes, "Oh, look at that!" And he walked, and as Chris said, he walked along a few extra yards, stopped, looked at his finger, and said, "God, well, if I had a gun, what my finger could do," he said, "I could feed my family." So, in a sense, if you like, that's a way of describing what a shotgun is. As you know, it's the extension of your finger, and somehow along it somehow he must have told a friend who worked for a gunsmith, and he ran off and said, "Oh, we've got this great way for the arrows, for the aristocrats to shoot more birds quicker. You don't need seven loaders and eight Brown Bess muskets to shoot it." And that's really it. And I do think that what you're doing is still keeping it's teaching people about the history. And again, I'm sure there are many, many clay shooters around the world that really think that the shotgun was invented to shoot clays. Well, it wasn't. It was just invented for aristocrats to shoot driven pheasants. And to a degree, I'll go on. This is why that I think the great thing is your the UGC. One of the things I think has been very important you do is you now you have what I call straight flat butt pads on all your models, I believe. Is that correct? I don't think you produce the concave butt plate with a
Not
pointed
really,
toe.
no.
No, because you
Maybe if
see.
somebody will, if somebody really wanted that. Maybe, but no, that's not what we do. And I
Yeah,
know,
well,
I've talked to you about the butt pads before.
yeah, because again, that's very important, because it's like, as I told you, we've discussed before, the word field has, by crossing the Atlantic, confused American upland shooters. Because you see, quite naturally, if they see, oh, it's a field gun, they naturally think that this is designed for me to go and walk in a field. You go and walk and hunt the birds. Well, really, it's not, because you see, the classic field gun, which may have the round butt, the round grip, the Prince of Wales grip, okay, or
Yeah.
And then they have that very concave butt pad that comes down to a point. Well, again, it's, as we've said, it's purely a traditional design to shoot driven pheasants. Because if someone's got one and they put the gun right vertical in their shoulder with their cheek on the stock, that is fine. It will roll over the shoulder. But with a pointy bit, you know, just on top of the soft tissue muscle, you know, and then as you lower the gun, that point naturally digs into the soft tissue and it starts becoming below 45 degrees. If you've got the gun vertical, from vertical to 45 degrees, it will fit your shoulder no problem. When it starts to drop below 45 degrees, that sharp toe starts to push into the soft tissue. And as the further you lower the gun, it becomes more uncomfortable. And what it actually does is it accentuates the cast. It will push the gun off your eye line. Some people still make that. And of course, it's a field gun. So, as we said, going off walking the field. But really, the aristocrat, the English aristocrat, and some of the European ones, in the old days, you know, when this started, the word field meant that, oh, come on, chaps, we're off to the field. It just meant they're going outside. Didn't mean they were going to go and walk in the field. Come on, chaps, we're off to the field. Actually, it meant we're going to go outside and we're going to shoot some driven birds. Because you see, to the aristocrats, the word field has always meant going outside. For instance, from the early days of warfare, you went to the field of combat. You know, even from the, you know, Vikings up to, you know, Waterloo, armies went to a field of combat. Now, obviously, all the aristos, most of them, had sort of fought in the army or been in it. So, come on, chaps, we're off to the field. It just meant they were going outside. It's not meant that they were going to walk in a field. So just a little bit of change there. So when you see some of the traditional designs for a field gun, it's more for driven targets, not for shooting birds going away from you in a walk up in a field. And of course, as we've said, it's certainly not a good fit for ladies, you know. And if you've got a pointed toe, my advice is get out in the garage quick, get your largest follow, and start round it off.
Sand it off.
Yeah. Well. Also, it's like, again, don't forget, if you've got such a concave butt pad, if you do try and shoot it lower than 45 degrees, don't forget it affects the pitch, on the gun, on the pad. As I say, below 45 degrees, it really becomes more of a hindrance than anything else, you know, to the shooting. But I mean, the great thing is, as we've said, I know I always put on the report that fabric round toe, but you're the company that actually does it. I'm not knocking anyone, but you know, if there are certain people that if you said, well, why is it like that, and they'd say, well, it's tradition. There's a lot of people that don't really know why that, even gun makers, why it is that shape. And so on. So full credit to you, lads. Top guns.
Well, we maybe stumbled into that, but I have always remembered you discussing that, the concave butt pad and that being for driven shooting. You know, obviously most of the listeners of this podcast are going to be thinking, when they hear the word field, they're going to be thinking exactly as you described, in that we're going for a walk through the uplands, probably behind our bird dogs, and we're going to shoot walked up flush birds, that sort of thing. Just before we leave that, are there any other differences between what you would consider a game gun for walked up birds versus driven birds? Are there any other differences in those, how those two shotguns are set up?
I think firstly, for driven birds, you do, if you can, need that longer barrel. A 30-inch barrel on a gun is fine. They were being built even in the late 19th century and, of course, through the 20th century. You know, that if you look, the hammer guns and everything, you look at the guns of that period, they were 30-inch, because obviously it had to reach up, you had to get up to those birds. I think here, when you're walking up, and if if you're walking up on what I call typical grassfield moorland, well, of course, the good old 28 is spot on. But, you know, whether you've got an over and under or side by side, it's spot on. Funny enough, when you're going off, and I've only encountered this now since I've been in America, was obviously when you go off and hunt quail, you know, you go down south and you're walking through almost jungle-style woodland and so on. And, of course, your movement's going to be restricted. You're trying to, you know, you've got lots of trees around you. That's really where the old 26-inch barrel is very useful, because you're not shooting birds at long distance, and you've not got vast amounts of room to wave the big barrels around. And, of course, as you know, if you've got a longer barrel, it creates like a golf club. You know, it's the heavier the head, the more momentum it creates. And you can very rapidly, over accelerate past the bird purely because of the momentum. So as I'm saying, and of course, very interesting, if people don't know, when Robert Churchill invented the 26-inch barrel, he got a lot of stick and a lot of criticism, from the gun makers and everything around them, the ballistics. And he proved that the ballistics really didn't really alter that much. And his word had to be accepted, because he was the first ever forensic ballistic firearms expert for Scotland Yard. But he got a lot of stick for it, and sales really didn't go, as expected. But the first gun he sold, the first 26, was sold to an American gentleman who wanted it for quail and grouse in his plantation in Southern America. That's how that works. And so here, again, because there is a variety, I've said before, you're very fortunate here. You've got this variety of countryside, which we don't get in England or Europe, where you've got all these different birds and the different environments you're going to have to go and shoot them in. And you can make, or they can now buy a gun that suits that individual environment. All people have to learn. It's the classic one when the older chap goes in England, he would go from his 12 gauge to a 20 gauge when he was driven shooting, because it got heavy. He was getting on walking over the ploughs, fields to get to the woods. The only thing people have to do is just be aware of the handling characteristics will change. You know, the lighter the gun, it goes off quicker, loses momentum earlier. So you when you're handling it, it's just like driving your SUV with your 12 gauge compared to a sports car coupe with your 26-inch barrel. So that's really the difference. So again, if you're going to go out and you're shooting high birds, if you are going to a driven shoot, terror shoot, you know, your 30 inch is great and your 28. But if you're, say, going into the old heavy undergrowth, sometimes the 26 is the gun to take. And again, you know, it's ball power to your elbow that, you know, all these shooters here have the difference. I know there are lots of people that change their sleeves in the gun, but that doesn't alter barrel length. It just alters, you know, chamber diameter.
Right.
So here it's great that you've got a gun to suit the bird and the environment in which you're going to have to go off and hunt that bird. Oh, it's just very good.
Yeah. Yeah. The barrel length conversation, that definitely kind of aligns with sort of the classic thinking, you know, the short barrel brush gun. And I've shot guns like that. I think we end up oftentimes building longer barrels on some of our game guns, but that has a lot to do with how light some of the Italian side-by-sides are. So light.
Yeah.
All your comments about the momentum and the inertia. So we do a lot of 30-inch barrels on the little 20s and 28s, but those guns are so centrally balanced that if you go a whole lot shorter than that, then they become really whippy.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, it'd just be like a little wandy stick you're waving around. Yeah. And I mean, as you know, my good friend Mark Hinkle, who was a great side-by-side aficionado, you know, he brought the 28, that's got 30-inch barrels on that. And I'd seen him, you know, after he got it. I mean, I saw him shooting, if you like, climbing driven birds, you know, and he was popping those down at sort of like, I don't know, 100 yards, you know, the big, you know, and it just worked. It was just a perfect gun to shoot. It's with the lighter gun, the same with the Italians making another gun, having those extra barrels, that little bit more metal in the, if you like, in the club head, just keeps the swing under control. It stops, as you say, whipping away and just, you know, an uncontrolled shot, I think you would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, like you pointed out, I mean, we have the luxury because we build them one by one and because RFM is willing to do them individually, you can design it the way that you want it. You know, so if that's a 28, 29, 30 inch, 26 inch, however the customer wants to set it up, that's what we can do. And that's one of the things that makes Upland Gun Company unique, which listeners are probably well aware of at this point. Every time I hear your voice, Keith, I know I'm going to hear the story about the wood pigeon and the rabbit and the pointing of the fingers. it's one of my favorite, but it just makes so much sense. Do you differentiate? Because I have this concept in my head. I just think of a game gun or a double gun being a side by side or an over under. There are differences between the two. I think they're kind of subtle. I definitely have an interest in the side. I really enjoy shooting side by sides for game shooting, but I really think you can build a good game gun on either platform. How do you differentiate side by sides and over unders, if at all, if somebody's asking you that question?
Well, I think generally over and unders tend to be what I would call a little more robust in the body.
Deeper action.
Yeah, and of course, it just gives the feeling that this is, as I say, the SUV. You know, it's a solid piece of kit, and it's great.
Yeah.
And of course, the game gun, I know it sounds a strange word for a man to use, but it's an elegant gun. You know, it's an elegant gun. It's not a big, chunky vision. Yeah, that's the word I'm trying to, you know, when you look at it, you look at it side by side, and you look at an over and under, and you think the over and under, you go, cool, yeah, that's a bit of a meatier gun. You shouldn't feel it, but it looks it. And I think sometimes that's really the biggest difference. But going back to it, yeah, I do just think that when you see a side by side, for me and all of us, it's just got that slightly more, I don't know, it's a bit more elegant, a bit more gentlemanly, isn't it? That's how I would say it's a more gentlemanly style look to it and feel. But I'll tell you what, I had a quick go. Dan brought that your trap side by side.
Oh yeah, we call it the pigeon gun or the BRT.
Yeah. Well, I had a shoot of that, and I thought that was the brilliant, clever combination, side by side. You know, really made for the pigeon ring, I would have thought, and with that high rib,
right up your alley.
Yeah, I tell you, it was cracking. It's a brilliant sporting clay gun. Little heavy maybe for the sporting clays, but my word, what a great bit of kit. Don't let anybody ever say you can't shoot sporting clays with a side by side. Go. That really was. I was very impressed with that. That was a grand bit of kit. And if you like, combined too, didn't it? It's got the beefiness of an over and under, but still with what I would call an elegant, good-looking gun. Good combination.
And that definitely has the raised flat rib to where you're it's very comparable to over under shooting, definitely designed for that kind of shooter. But I do think the SUV sports car analogy works fairly well. You know, it varies a lot just gun to gun. You can obviously gun makers can build a dainty, sleek little over under as well, but just as a general rule, the SUV to sports car analogy kind of works. The one idea that I've read and at least sounds good on paper is and I think Lars Jacob talked about this when I interviewed him, is that you refer to it, the depth of the action, the side by side is a shallower action, which gets your hands closer to that, you know, back to the Chris Craddock story, that actually it's a tool that's made for pointing at the bird, and kind of really puts your hands right on the line of sight. That's the one that I sort of refer back to in my mind. Again, it's a concept on paper, but it makes sense, at least to me.
Well, the good thing is that, again, good modern side-by-sides now have what I call a beefier forend. You know, the original guns, and of course a lot of guys buying these antique guns. It's a splinter forend. And of course there wasn't hardly anything, there wasn't much to grip onto. So of course people would roll their fingers around the barrel. And that's why you see some of these old Jackson Field with their leather glove. But of course really the reason it was splinter is, I think I've said to you, if you put, you know, the forend, if you splay your palm and you put the forend, you know, over your palm like that.
Yeah.
Okay. The forend will naturally sit like that, and of course goes across that finger. And then you can actually curl your fingers back and you can grip the wood. You can actually grip the wood. You don't have to do that. So but all forends on side by sides and over, I think we told you, it splay your hand, put that forend across so it goes over that forefinger, and then you grip it. And of course, the reason it was the splinter forend was done like that was so that, of course, really, the barrel was again just an extension of your finger. So it was like that. And I think now, balance is, and getting the balance right is very important now. You can have a light gun, but it's having the balance right. You can have a light gun that is fine, feels perfect. What sometimes you'll find is, regrettably, you'll get some guns that are light in the wrong place. They take the weight out of stock, and then of course the weight's on the forend, and of course that then doesn't it increases the energy from recoil, and it makes the gun too heavy on the front hand. And I see this with a lot of lady shooters. You know, people alter guns, and their husbands come along and think they're doing the right thing. But really, you need the weight in the butt, not the forend. It's the weight in the butt that absorbs the energy. And of course, you want it nice and balanced, so your front hand is not, or your front arm is not being fatigued by keeping the gun up, by the weight in the gun. And invariably, that's what happens. And you see this so much to a degree with females and juniors. You know, if you see someone who's bending backwards with a gun in their shoulder, you know, you notice that again, they're bending backwards from the hip. It's because
they're trying to offset that weight.
Yeah, what they're doing is they're taking the weight with their back muscles, not with their front hand. So again, balance on a gun is very important to get it right. You know, so it's a comfortable gun to shoot. And it's a gun that you can handle, you know, efficiently. That's very important. So sometimes people, you know, they don't take that into account. How's the balance? Yeah, that's a way to do it. And
I got a question for you. So this has come up from time to time over the years. I'm sure you've been asked this, but some folks they'll get their finger, the second finger on their trigger hand, banged up by the trigger guard.
Yeah. Now that
I've
gone.
What are your thoughts on the cause? Is it the weight of the gun, the grip?
No, it's the grip.
You'll read different things.
Yeah, okay. It's the grip. Now, obviously, what you've got is you've got what I call, you've got the traditional straight neck stock. Okay?
Yep.
Straight neck.
English grip.
Yeah, that's what they call the English grip. So what
is
happened
that offensive
was,
to you?
No, mate, I'm an Englishman. English grip. And that's what it was originally, okay? Yeah. So that's how shotgun, that was the original configuration of the stock on a shotgun, okay?
You would see that on some of the old muskets and stuff too, right?
Well, that's what was, yeah. See, because don't forget, again, this has still been based, a lot of this came out, they were still using a musket stock. If you can imagine, this is the development of shotguns. Through particularly the late 18th and all through the 19th century in up to almost the post First World War. Okay.
Yeah.
Now the story that Chris told me was that where they're shooting straight stock. Now of course Edward VII, he was a bit of a lad, as you know, Victoria's son, and all he wanted to do was shoot, drink, gamble, chase women. Not a bad hobby from my point of view. But they would go out in the field, okay? Into the field. Remember, we're going to the field.
Right.
Not walking.
Out to the peg.
We're going out to the peg. And these chaps, I mean, I forget what the record was for pheasants. I think he and seven guns over a day sort of shot over 1,500 pheasants. Well, he was a chunky lad and he had a big chunky hand. Now, you can imagine that what was happening, by the time he got to his 1,200th pheasant, his hand was starting to slide up, okay, the neck. That's what you have, the neck. And, of course, he was bashing, as you say, his finger. And apparently the story goes that one day he was on a peg and he shouted out, "Oh, can somebody get me a bloody gun I can grip?" So, of course, some quick-thinking lad, "Blimey, the king needs a gun, he needs a grip on." So he obviously got on his bike, pedalled back down to London and rushed in to the gun maker where he worked and said, "The king needs a gun, he needs a grip." So it became the Prince of Wales grip. Now, if you've got a Prince of Wales gun, if you've got that grip,
there it is.
Okay, that is because it was designed purely for the Prince of Wales. Now, again, development. We talked about they were using muskets and that's why the straight neck was on the shotgun, because that's the way stocks were. Then they got the pistol grip. Now, if you've got a grip, a gun with an English grip, you know, that Prince of Wales, put it on the table, and if you like, follow it down. You know, it stops there, but just imagine it carries on further down. You know, if you look at it, what is it? It's a grip from a flintlock pistol. Mm. That's where that came from. It's half the size of a flintlock pistol grip.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's the same as on an over and under. If you look at a standard pistol grip on an over and under, it comes from a Colt 45 or
right.
That's what it was. So it's that same. But what can happen now, and the reason why people are bashing their fingers, is because their hand is too far up the grip. Okay? Well, see how the angle, I don't know if you can see it, but see that I'm holding the gun, if I'm on a pistol grip, for me, the base of the grip has to be flush with the base of my palm. Now, if I go up the grip, can you see what happens to my arm? Look, watch this. My arm goes up, the angle changes, and now I'm blocking the view down the rib. But that's what happens. And I'm going to get a bit of stick for this, because particularly with upland shooters, everybody's over-obsessed with their safety catch. Now, I'm a stickler for safety, but also at the same time, you know, you don't rely on technical things to be safe. You rely on yourself.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
No, you don't rely on the safety. So what they do is they've got the finger and they've got their thumb So they come up the grip because their thumb's on the safety catch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, of course, their hand goes up there. And they're constantly on there. No, don't do that. Come back down. That's how your hand should be. Not like that. So that pulls the arm away, does everything. So what happens is the further your hand goes up the grip, the more they smash their knuckle, that on the trigger grip.
That purely second hand, finger, yeah.
Yeah, it's purely what you've got to do is if, for instance, as I advise clients, look, it's like the bloke in Black Hawk Down says when he gets caught by the ranger guy. He says, hey, sir, it's a hot, he's in the mess. He says, that's a hot weapon. And he says, well, that's my safety catch, sir. And I think really people should think about that more and more. Don't rely on this. Because remember, all the safety catch does is stop the trigger being pulled. Okay? Doesn't stop the gun going off, in a sense, if you fall over. But be disciplined. But that's a big cause of it. People are holding, whether you've got your thumb on the safety catch or not, all right, that's the main reason I see it. But a lot of people do have their hand too far up the grip. Now, the further you go up the grip, it's going to push your finger forward and change the angle.
Yeah.
What people are going to do when you hold your gun, if you've got a grip, it's got to be flush. You know, that's the bottom of the grip. It's got to be, your palm's got to be. So you've got to come down. That's why there's that recess for your thumb. So if your hand's too far forward, your thumb doesn't fit in the recess. If you come back properly, of course, then your thumb naturally folds into that recess in front of the comb. That's what it's made for.
Why they call it the thumb hole, right?
Absolutely. But it's very difficult. Remember, when you're buying a straight neck gun, a straight neck gun is tradition. It's what, that was the first guns. Okay? There is no, it's not any more efficient or whatever. If anything, the straight neck, my advice to you is to wear a glove. You know, because what will happen if you hang, you will start to slide up the neck. And again, I go back, it's even worse with the safety catch thing because you've got no reference to where your hand should be. You know, if you've got the straight neck, use that thumb hole, get that thumb curled into that place properly, and that will give you the correct hand position on the stock against the trigger. But again, you can't keep walking around with your thumb on the safety catch because you're doing that. And that is what we're also going, if you're on a straight neck, your hand will go up and you'll start bashing that finger on the back of the trigger guard. So it's, you consider it. Have a look at it. A lot of people, you know, when people come along to me and I suggest changes, they go, oh, doesn't feel right. Well, no, it won't, because it's new. And as I've always said to people, it's different. And as I've said to people, as you know, that with the gun mount, because it feels right doesn't mean it actually is right. The human's clever, as I said, people that have guns that they haven't had any reference to the fitting and the length of the stock. As I say, we will adapt. The human's very clever. We will adapt ourselves to the gun incorrectly. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't do that. That's why you're having a gun fitted. And of course, it's the critical factor is always the length of pull. And as I say to people, remember, think of it this way. A lot of people now think of the comb height and the cast, if you like, as independent measurements. All right? Well, if you're doing that means you're out of a body norm. I think we discussed this before. And when people come along for a fitting, I think people are surprised that I don't have what I call a multi-jointed trigun. My trigun is purely extendable or reducible, and it's cast. Because logically, think of it this way. If your gun is too short, your comb's going to be too high. So once you lengthen the stock, the comb is in the right place. And of course, don't forget, if you lengthen a stock, you're graduating the cast, aren't you? You know, mm-hmm. if it's only this long, the cast's only going to be that much. If it goes that long, it graduates out. Okay? And of course, so does
everything on an angle. So as you lengthen or shorten, you're moving further up or down on that angle.
Yeah, and as you've seen, when I do the report, because the first thing, if you say came along and we were chatting, and I'd say, well, how tall are you? What, 5'10"? 5'11"?
6.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. 6 foot, yeah. So that's the main measurement, right? What I'm looking at is your height, okay? Then, of course, I ask people, if it mainly men, obviously, I'll ask a somewhat more discreet question of the ladies, and I'll ask the men, what's your shirt size? See, me, I'm hopefully now down to a 2XL or reducing to an XL. Right? But if you look at it, right, we are now in body norms. In the 18th, or certainly in the 19th century, and up to the Second World War, there were no body norms. That's why there were so many gun makers in London, because people were different. And you have to remember, it was the aristocracy. It's not Joe Public. No one had guns.
Right. And they were custom making them one by one.
So. Yeah, that's right, one by one. So, and as I've always said, like the aristocracy, well, there's two things about them. They're incredibly, they could have been very overfed and very interbred. So you've got a variation of size. Yeah. That's why you needed a knuckle-jointed gun, because there was more variation in size. Now, since the Second World War and everybody's, most people's diet have got better and whatever, and we've got orange juice, we've got into body norms. Now, the only way sometimes you would have to consider the comb height and the cast as independent is if you were out of a body norm. Like here, if you're an American football player and you're built like a tank, like I had to do, you know, the professional bodybuilder who was like 5'7" and he had no neck, pectoral muscles that were taller than he was, you know, lying down. So the only time
he's going to have a different gun fit.
Absolutely. I mean, this poor chap, I mean, he had a stock that I think was about 12 inches long, and it had about almost a 3/4-inch cast. Now, when you put the gun down on the table, you'd think, bloody hell, what's that? But funny enough, when he picked it up, it looked right. So, but going back to it, when we talk about gun fit now, critical factor, as I've always said, is the way you mount the gun. Now, of all people, hundreds of thousands of shooters, the most important element is the gun mount, and yet hardly anybody pays any attention to it.
Right, right.
Because we're all men, and we know, and of course, the problem is the brain gives you incorrect assumptive information. Because remember, it's got the word gun in it. And the brain goes, oh, I know how to use a gun, don't you worry about it. And immediately it tells you it's a rifle. But it's not. It's not nothing to do with a rifle. It wasn't invented to be a rifle. It wasn't meant to be used by a rifle. But the brain tells you, you have to treat it like a rifle. And everybody just thinks, oh, yeah, I'll put the gun in my shoulder and people drop their head and do all sorts of amazing things. But if people really just took a step back and like we've done today, what's a shotgun? Essentially, you point it. Now, when we do a gun fit, the critical factor is, what am I doing? Is I'm getting the extended finger to line up with my eye, you know, with your eye. That's what I'm doing. Now, that's what a gun fit is about. That bit of wood, the stock, which is a backstop to keep the metal finger, we've got to get that piece of wood under, right under there. Can you see that? What the buttress bone of the cheek?
Okay? Yeah.
Under there. So, of course, what does it do? If you put your finger up, it goes up to the eye, doesn't it? Right. Now, that's where the comb has to sit. Not here. Now, this is where gun fitting or gun making with America took a slight diverse course in the latter part of that 19th century, is because the rifle was the predominant thing. And it had an effect on American gun makers own stocks. You can find some of the older, you know, it was designed because they would put the gun next to the cheekbone, not underneath it, like a rifle. So that's the big difference. The comb of a shotgun has to go right under there, because then it's right under your eye. Not there, because that's why people roll their head and stuff like that. Yeah. So it is this concept. And when people come along, as I say to them, you know, great, we're going to do this today, and I'll perhaps have a look at the gun. We always check the gun out. And invariably, it does need some alteration. But as I say to people, the hardest battle goes on in the brain. This old boy up here, Mr. Conscious, he just wants you to throw that stock in your shoulder and do all sorts of things and bring your head down, because your brain's going, it's a rifle. And the hardest bit is when you see people, they're trying to do what I'm asking them. And I say to them, don't get frustrated, because it's going to be a lot more difficult than what you think, because your brain is, Mr. Conscious is going to resist it. You know, it's screaming at you, put it in the shoulder. And you really, it's very difficult to override. But all of a sudden they do it, and all of a sudden, bang, that light bulb goes on, comes straight up under there, and their eye is straight down the rib. But it's changing this here. The biggest battle goes on here.
Yeah, you've got to rewire the neurons, basically.
Yeah, it's reprogramming. Your brain insists it's a rifle. No, it's not. You've got to tell him, take the day off, Mr. Conscious. Let Mr. Subconscious do it. But it's true. And this is, this is why I'm going to upset the clay shooters now. Most clay shooters don't go for a lesson. They go up to their mate, they put the gun up, and he does what his mate tells him.
Yeah.
It, like in golf, though, most people go for a lesson with a pro to learn how to swing the club. But of course, because it's guns, no, we don't have to do that. I know. But it's wrong. The brain is giving you incorrect information. He is giving you information based on shooting a rifle. And it's wrong. And if you are trying to shoot your shotgun like a rifle, regrettably, mate, you're not doing it in the most efficient way. It's a lot more simple, but you've got to learn how to just treat your shotgun like your extended finger. But the critical finger, and the thing is, as I said to you, remember, get it under there. You know, I mean, I know you can see this, but you remember the old three finger?
Tucked right under your cheekbone. Yeah. Yep, I remember the three fingers.
So if that represents my comb, okay, if I hold my arm at right angles, not back here, at a right angle, right, and my head is straight, if I roll my three fingers back, where's the top finger?
Right, just under the eye.
Right under the eye, isn't it? So that's why, if the stock is the correct length and you mount the gun properly, that's why you should have a gap of three fingers between the tip of your nose and the end of the comb. Because if you do that, okay, or, you know, if you do that, that's where the comb is. The rib should be level with your eye. Now, okay, because remember, that's the one measurement on all humans that's identical. Doesn't change for anybody. Well, unless you're a French bell ringer with a big lump on your back, but that's the same. That's the same on every human being. If you do it properly, that's how these clever shot, as I said to you, I think Chris said to me one day in the late 19th century, the stock maker was looking for something that he could use as a constant measurement. And he was walking around one day, but of course in those days in London, you know, you could go to a public autopsy, you know, or medical thing. And he must have been walking by Bart's Hospital one day, and they said, oh, we're doing something on the brain, or the face and the brain, or the head. And he, oh, I'll have a look at that. And he went in, and obviously they got the skull, and the doctor went, yeah, sure, that's the same. And he went, bloody hell. Sorry, pardon that, British intern. He said, blimey, look at that. And someone must have realised that's the same. So whether you were a short, dumpy aristocrat or a tall, lanky aristocrat, that measurement was going to be the same.
Yeah.
So that's how they came about. So again, we go back to the conversation. So much of what shotgun shooting is is not taken into account is the history of why the shotgun was invented.
Right.
And it was purely a necessity for aristocrats to shoot high birds, and at point. And again, it's like now, it's like clay shooting. It's all about gizmos and gadgets. I mean, again, compare it to golf. How did golf start? It was invented by a lot of hairy-legged Scotsmen running around with curved sticks, knocking stones down rabbit holes. Now look at it. You know, as my old friend who is a golf pro, he used to say, yeah, what wins on Sunday sells on Monday.
Right.
He sold more golf clubs. He didn't do more lessons. He just sold more golf clubs.
Right.
And I think that's very similar now to what's happened. Not so much I'm pleased to say the great thing is not so much in hunting, but it is happening in clay shooting.
Right. Right.
You know, the adjustable comb is the worst thing I ever think was invented, because all it does is allowed somebody to fit a gun to a not efficient technique, a poor technique. You shouldn't move
it. It could be used properly, but it could very easily be used improperly, right?
Absolutely. And regrettably, it's not anyone's fault they're using it improperly. You can blame it on the brain. You know, it's this inbuilt program that says, and as Chris Craddock said, the worst thing they did when they invented it was put the word gun in it. They should have called it a pointy bang stick, which is really what it is. Isn't it? It's a pointy bang stick. Yeah. And he said, if they'd have called it a pointy bang stick, people would have gone, oh, I don't know how to use that. I better go and
I better learn how to use that. Exactly. Yeah.
Again, I think this is a great thing. When we chat, when we're talking now, you know, it's not just about shooting. You've given me the opportunity maybe to give a little bit of background to the history of a shotgun. And why we need it to have it fitted, you know. Well, because people say, well, why do you have to have it fitted? Well, it's because it's like a golf club. You know, if you're 6 foot, it's no good going and buy a set of sticks that are made for a man of 5'6".
Yep.
It's exactly the same thing. And the reason we have to have it fitted is because we have to bring it to our eye. You know, it's not a rifle. We're not bringing the Mark One eyeball gun sight to the gun. We have to bring the gun or the pointy banging stick to line up with our eye, because all it is doing is imitating the action of our pointing finger. So, you know, if people did just know a little bit more about the history and the background of what's a shotgun, you know, it would help them review the fact that perhaps I ought to maybe think about, you know, finding out a bit more. Am I doing things right? Should I go and see somebody just to check my gun fit, you know? And, you know, don't be afraid of spending a few dollars to get this done, because it's going to save you a lot more dollars in the long run by being more successful. You know what you're doing, whether you're hunting and shooting clays. If you've got it all right, you're going to make less holes in the sky and hit more targets. So, but again, hey, not everybody, you know, not everybody wants to do that. I understand. And there we are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the option is there, and I can speak from personal experience. Gun fitting, whether you build a custom gun or not, I really do see it as it's an investment in, you know, this is a hobby. It's a pastime for most of us. It's something we really enjoy doing, and we usually want to do things better or we're sort of process improvement oriented. And in my gun fittings, I've learned a lot about my own shooting and my gun mount and how to be more efficient as a shooter. Again, some of those things directly apply to a custom gun from RFM, Upland Gun Company, but you also learn a lot about just your own shooting, the guns that you have, how to shoot the guns that you have better, or maybe if a gun's just not right for you. So I do think it's a good starting point for a lot. Like a custom gun is sort of out there as a, as an option, but from a shooting and instruction perspective, you know, gun fitting and shooting instruction, that's like the first step, in my opinion. If you were of a mind to, hey, I like this, I enjoy this, I'm looking for the next step, doing a gun fitting or a shooting lesson would be that next step. At least that's how I would think about it. I did want to ask you, you know, I think it's sort of obvious that gun fitting is at the core of what you would do for instruction. But if somebody comes to you and just says, hey, I want to do a shooting lesson, maybe they don't bring up the word gun fit. How do those things relate and how do you assess that?
Well, when you come along for a lesson, the first thing again that we always will, the first thing we look at is the way you mount the gun, the way you stand. Because invariably this rifleman thing creeps in all over the place. Okay. So when you're just coming for a shooting lesson, the first thing we're going to look at is your gun mount and your stance. You know, if you're shooting like a rifleman with your front shoulder pushed forward and your feet, if I'm a right-hander, instead of your left foot being at 12 o'clock, it's round at 1 o'clock and your right foot's at 3 or 4 o'clock. Well, that's just shooting a rifle, and that's not the way you need to be. So the first thing we do, come in, hello, Nick, right, let me have a chat. You tell me what you're shooting, I'll get a feel for your background and so on. So, right, okay, well, right, first thing we're going to do, let's have a look at the gun mount. Let's see what's happening. You know, are you dropping your head? You know, invariably, most people put the gun in the shoulder first and so on. So we do that. So, that's a very critical part. But I do give people the option of whether they want to change or not. You know, we work out invariably, and I don't think it's people not wanting to upset me, but eventually they go, oh, yeah, it feels different. Oh, I don't know about that. And again, a lot of the things is moving the front hand, you know, don't have the finger down the side, particularly clay shoes, put it across your palm. So we're doing that. But unconscious, what they don't realise is I'm also assessing the fit as they're doing it. Because once I get the gun, once I do that, I can see what, you know, I can immediately see the gun is either the stock's too short, you know, or it's too long. The stock might be the right size, but their front hand is too far forward. Which, as you know, you move that front hand forward, it has the effect. So even in that first, if they're coming along, it's only a two-hour session for a lesson. Even in that very first bit, I will be able to say to them, look, you know, that stock's really too long, too short. Okay? And that's the first thing. And then what I can do is I can put a boot onto their stock to extend it, or they use my tri-gun. We go out, and then we will then move into truly a shooting lesson. And, of course, you may know now that I wouldn't say I was bullied, but people kept going on to me. Because obviously, you know, I am linked to Churchill. And of course, the method goes back to Churchill. And everybody asks what's the instinctive system. And of course, one tries to explain it. But then over the years, and remember, when I was working for Roger Silcox for all that, those 3 years full time, I didn't realise then, in a sense, that of course, what is instinctive shooting? Okay, people don't know. Well, I'll tell you what it is, and I've come forward with it now because I was calling it Churchill. But in actual fact, the system that I prescribe is what I now call the convergence system, which can be used by pre-mounted shooters, and certainly it's beneficial for shooting no gun. Because ultimately, when we point a finger, we always converge up on a flat diagonal approach to the target. Because that's what if you like, what I've done is I've taken Churchill, and without realising it, I've modernised it a little bit, because I originally was a clay shooter, you know.
Yeah.
So, and then when it was only, again, good friends, Mark Hinkle, Dave Brewer, Gene Hay, people were saying to me, well, actually, it's really your system, isn't it? And I thought, well, right, yeah. And again, people said to me, look, you've moved it on. You've now got Churchill's system advanced, and hopefully, it's become somewhat simpler. So now what I'm getting people to do now with a lesson, I didn't realize I've been doing it, but I've been teaching them the convergence method. And the convergence method is one that, again, is purely based on our instinctive ability to point, but it's applying that in a way that shooters can apply it and understand it, okay? And, of course, so many clay shooters now are shooting pre-mounted.
Well, right, right.
The problem is that with pre-mounted, so many shooters are starting with the gun exactly on the flight path of the target, okay? They get the pickup point, they're on the flight path of the target, and they go zoom in. And, of course, they're having to constantly keep pace with the target physically, you know, oh, I'm doing it. Whereas really, you know, what I've got most pre-mounted shooters to do now is they do everything right. They get the pickup point, okay? We know when we're going to break the target. But what I do is I now get them to set the gun a distance below the flight line. Because what we don't want to do is make two movements. We don't want to go up and along. We want to converge.
Yeah.
Right? So what they do is, if you imagine, I've got people now just putting the gun a little bit under the flight path, okay? Because if you start pointing it, you'll actually start lifting and converge onto the target. So it's a far more efficient way to match the speed of the target. And in actual fact, by the time, again, you, instead of doing like running with it and then going ahead, if pre-mounted, as you see it, you go up and converge on it, by the time you make contact, by the time that finger touches the bird, you've built up natural momentum, not what I call forced momentum. And all of a sudden it becomes really easy, because then you come onto it and all you've got to do is just add more energy, even for a gun up shooter, to push the gun away from the target. If you're a gun up shooter and the target's a long way away, then set your gun a little bit lower below the flight path, and then big movement to climb up on it. And of course, by the time they get there, because, of course, they are shooting pre-mounted, they still will have to push the barrels ahead of a target, but it will be much easier. You know, you're not coming on, you're having to try and measure it. It will be far, it's far more natural. You converge on it, come up, as you make touch, it's the same as shooting, if you like it, and then the gun down shooter, it's even better. Because, again, he just converges up on it. And particularly if you watch fitter shooters, you know they have got to shoot gun down. Okay, because they've got the mark on the vest. Well, if you watch most fitter shooters, what they do is they see the target and they just rush the gun up into the shoulder, and then they chase after the bird because they want to shoot it mounted. There it goes, and they do two movements. No, it just one converging movement. You know, because they go, oh, chase. Oh, look, come up, one smooth movement. And, of course, don't forget all those fitter shooters that are listening. That mark on your vest, that's the highest you can have, right? But you can lower it. Doesn't mean that's where it's always got to start. As I say to people, look, if it's a target bigger away, think of it like a golf swing. You know, the further that target is out, make a bigger movement. So it means lowering the gun down to create a really big stretch.
And you're like naturally building in the acceleration of the gun versus that rigid forced movement.
Absolutely. And as I say, it's when you look at it, I mean, so I've only really sort of started to think about this over this last year. And, you know, I remember the words Roger said to me when I went to work for him at Rose's Wood. And he said, look, Keith, he says, I don't want you to be a clone of me. He said, you're going to learn from me. He said, and then it's your job to take it on and improve it. Improve it all the time. It's what every good tutor does. He teaches you what he knows. Now you take it and learn it and then add on what you learn from experience and extra knowledge. So in a sense, that's really what I've done. And it's great. I'm very pleased to say, people who have come along, the number of, I always say to people, let me know you're getting on. It's great. I've got a drawer full of like lovely letters and emails, people saying, it's brilliant. And the nice thing is, it's when we go out and we're shooting, and all of a sudden, of course, it's new, so it's a bit enforced, isn't it? And then all of a sudden, as I say to people, stop thinking about it. Just do it. And of course, you know, right? And they just let it go. No thought. And the look on the face when that tray just explodes in the sky, and you know, and I know what they're thinking. They're thinking, who did that? Did I do that? That was easy. And that's the great feeling of it. And I think, as I say, what I'm trying to do is still keep that whole traditional instinctive method of pointing your finger, but maybe trying to convert it into a modern parlance, a modern system that people can associate with what they're doing now, you know. And as I say, I'm very pleased. So hopefully one day someone will give me an award and I'll get a Nobel Prize to satisfy the USIS. But yeah,
any important people listening that can give those awards.
Yes, please. Yeah. but it's great. And as I said, that it's just a shame. Well, I'm not saying me, but it is just a shame that so many shooters out there don't think about going and seeing a good coach, not somebody who thinks he's a coach. Go and see a good, qualified, experienced coach that, you know, has been recommended. America's very lucky. You've got great ones out there, you know, or everywhere. There are good coaches. I just think it's such a shame that shotgunners do not want to spend a few quid in going and getting some good information, which is invariably opposite to what your brain's telling you, and so on. So from there. But again, very quickly going back to the guns, one of the things, going about history, someone said to me about, obviously, the having the gun, all the lovely engraving and the scroll work. Yeah. And again, it's history. Don't forget, shotguns were made for the aristocracy, and they like to show off. They like to show their other aristocratic mates, oh, I've just had this made, look at this. And there'd be this wonderful thing. That's why the engraving's on there, and it's so valued. So, sorry, I thought, I had my notes, and I haven't mentioned the engraving. And of course, that's what makes your gun unique, isn't it, really? I mean,
it's kind of a funny thing, it's this very functional tool that was fueled by that sort of extreme wealth and aristocracy. But along with that, you get the engraving and the beauty and the aesthetics. Yeah. And now we sort of depends on who you are as a shooter and what you like, but we have an appreciation for that pure function paired with sort of some of those fancy aesthetics.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we go back, when people talk about having a gun made, and I go back in, I think people, when they come through a fit, get a bit disappointed. I haven't got the old knuckle to a trident and all that.
Right, right.
Because I sometimes think they're not getting a bespoke fit. Well, yes, they are. It's not. We have to accept, as I said, we're body norms. Okay? But remember, so we talk about the measurement, critical on your methods of gun mount and stance, but we are body norms. Having said that, even though your gun might be the same size as the bloke who I've just seen last, you know, the measurements might be identical, doesn't matter, does it? That gun's still being made for you, isn't it? It's your gun. It doesn't matter about the measurements or anything, you know. It's your gun, and it's been made for you. You know, it's not come off a production line. You know, you've had blokes work, you know, with great skills, inherited skills, and they're applying this to your gun. So, again, it's like what guys are getting your guns equivalent to what an aristocrat would have his gun made for. So that's just put the price of your guns up, isn't it?
Yeah, right? Something like that.
Right. Yeah, but But that's the great thing. So again, just because measurements are the same as the bloke down the road, doesn't matter. When that gun arrives, it's yours. It's been made just for you. And I think that's just a wonderful feeling, you know, and it does give you that boost, and it gives you, and when you go out and you shoot it and you know you're shooting it well, gun a man in perfect harmony.
Confidence.
And, and I think you might have seen my little thing where I say, there is nothing like the feeling of a perfect shot. You know, you get you get that perfect shot, and you know it's perfect. And unexplainably, you get this feeling of it's perfection. You know, no one else could have done it any better, that, you know, whatever. And you get this wonderful feeling. And again, you know, as I've always said, you know, you go out on a shoot day, but I guarantee you, there'll always be one shot you'll remember forever. You'll be able to tell your mate 3, 10 years now, oh, when I was at so-and-so, this. And that's the great thing, isn't it? That's what we want to achieve. And
just like golf, that one shot that keeps you coming back.
Doesn't it? You know, and as I say to people, if you go back to your analogy, don't forget, every time you hit a target, be it a bird or a clay, it's a hole in one, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't get two or three shots. You might take two shots at it, but you don't get, it's not like you've either got it right or you got it wrong. And again, going back to coaching, the key is, if you are shooting, if you do something wrong, that you know what it is and you can put it right. You know, having the ability to self-analyze is also something that, if you like, comes in when we do coaching. You know, you've worked from your feet up and so on. But yeah, that one shot, you know, and that's man and gun in harmony. And as you said, it's like that great one golf shot. You know, it goes straight into that hole. You know, hits the flag straight in the hole. It's all what we want to achieve, isn't it? In some point in our lifetime, we all want to achieve some point of perfection, and enjoy doing it, you know,
or at least get closer to it.
Yeah. And as I say, but it's, I think we go back, it doesn't matter the dimensions of the gun. It's just knowing that gun's been handmade for you. That bloke was, you know, working on that stock. I know he's been doing it and with unbelievable care and skill. And it's just brilliant. And I go back. The other good thing is that now, obviously, there are more people walking around now with guns that are made for them. You know, it's very nice. You know, you might have 2 or 3 guns in the shelf or in the case, rather, you know, that you use, you know, you're over and under, your Bretter or your Browning and whatever. And then, you know, one day you it's like getting a, it's like having a, your full in the garage, which you use every day, your full, you know, SUV. And then one day you want to take out the old Mustang. They'll drop their Mustang, you know? And it's that, isn't it? You know, it's that sort of change. And again, once you know it fits you and it feels right, it's, glorious, mate, glorious.
Keith, do you have a favorite shotgun? I don't know if I've ever asked you that before.
Well, I've been very fortunate to handle the best, you know, Hollands and Purdy's and really, and even the old ones. For me, and people are surprised because they say, yeah, if you had all the money, what would you buy?
Yep.
And now, apart from a UGC side by side,
you don't have to say that.
No, well, it's true. But of all the guns I've fired or shot, rather, if I had all the money I could afford it, I would go and buy myself a Piraazi MX 2008 with a 30-inch. Barrel, and all I want is plain black action with the word Piraazi in gold.
I like that.
Yeah, which I don't know why, and this goes back to when I was working with Sam at Longacres, you know, years ago. Sam went off and treated himself to a Piraazi, you know, he brought this Piraazi in, and he said, "Oh, I looked at it and drawled over it, you know, caressed it, and called it George. And he said, go and have a look, have a go. Oh, yeah, righto. And Brendan will tell you, I went out, you know, there was all targets all over the shooting school, you know, the tower. And he had to come and drag me back in because I was whacking. I just couldn't miss. There was this wonderful feeling of gun and man in harmony. And yeah, one day if I'm ever rich enough. I mean, my original Beretta Onyx I brought in 1980. The only thing it ever suffered from was pilot error. It's been a cracking bit of kit, which unfortunately still rests with my mate in England. But yeah, if I started to go out to shoot again, because I hardly pick up a gun anymore, if I went out to shoot, yeah, Perazzi MX2000, mate, yeah. And then I might even go and have a go at the World Championships with it, who knows.
All right, Keith. Well, before we wrap this up, if somebody wants to look you up, come to the new venue, shooting school, gun fitting instruction, where do they go to do that? How do they get in touch with you, buddy?
Right. Well, the easiest way, purely just go onto the website, okay, keithcoyle.com, dead simple. It's been updated, I'm very pleased to say. And that's very good, thanks to my wonderful mate, Steve Jacks, back in England, who does everything. He's genius. So new website, and there's phone, as well as email. You can phone me now. All I say to people, if you do phone during the day, if you get the voicemail, it's purely because I'm coaching or doing a gun fit. I'm sure you appreciate I do not answer my phone on somebody else's time. Okay, so you get it. But yeah, all the info's on the new website. The website has been, I'd like to think it's easier to read, but it has got more information. You know, it's all updated. And while I'm talking about that, I'm sorry, just to let you know the online school, Only Perfect Practice.
Yep.
6 years old this month.
6 years this month.
Yeah, that went live in 2019, just again, very quickly.
Wow.
That website is now in the process of being completely updated. We've also altered, I've added some new bits to some of the existing courses. We've modernized the courses that people can buy into. I'm very pleased with that. I had no idea, you know, but yeah, 6 years. Yeah, 6 years now this year. So,
Can find that through, if they go to keithcoyle.com, tab here for online shooting school.
Yeah, I can do that. And very quickly, just as I've always explained, why did we do that? It's because the idea was it's like having, I tried to make it like you really are having a personal lesson with me. Okay.
Yeah.
There's no fancy diagrams or, you know, bits, but the idea, and it was for those people that couldn't hear to me, they were too far away, you know. And so that's why it's there. Although it's the school, yeah, you enroll in it, okay? So you only make one, it's only one payment, okay? But you've got it for lifetime, okay?
Yep.
And then, of course, if you buy on a course, what we've done now is if you then buy, you're already enrolled, but you enroll in another course, well, there's reductions for the courses. So we've really tried to bring it into, you know, into modern time. And but of course, the information is still as good as it was when we made it, you know. So there we are.
Yeah, it's so, pretty timeless stuff. I know I've seen some of the videos, and you know, anybody listening to a podcast is sort of a mind to digest information. You know, there's a time to consume information, digest information. There's also a time to go enact that information and go put it to use. But depending on where you are as a shooter, if you just are looking to get exposure to some of the concepts that Keith is talking about, visually see some stuff, it's a great starting point. And then, you know, hopefully you follow it up with an in-person lesson shooting instruction.
Yeah, sure. I mean, very quickly, the great thing about the online school is that we've done some podcasts, but we've got a lot of people that have been very kind to get hold of us. And we did some, you know, recorded some endorsements and, you know, people who have got value out of it. That I think that's the key. But again, I have to say, Nick, don't forget, we go back a long way. And it was really their first podcast with, the other Upland project that really put my name out there, put my name in the frame. Although I was hopefully fairly well known in the UK, I wasn't really a well-known name here in the US. And remember, I was brought over by the Hunt Club to introduce dribble meme shooting. For me, I said, well, can I run the school? For me, running the school was always what I call the bonus, doing the driven days and everything was great fun. But always, really what brought me here was the prospect of being again to open and run the shooting school. And it was, again, really thanks to yourself and a couple of others that, put my name out there and gave us a go. And here we are. This is my eighth year in the US. No, there we are.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't recall how long you had been here, but yeah, I don't remember. I just looked it up. That was the first time I interviewed you was episode number 28. So going way back within the first 30 episodes, that was May of 2018. And I don't remember how I came across you, or it might have been a listener that suggested it at the time, but I'm glad they did, and I appreciate you're still with us, Keith, and doing these interviews. So,
well, I'll keep you up to date. Once again, thanks very much for coming back to me. I always enjoy our chats, and I just hope the listeners enjoy it and get some fun out of it as well as information. Yep. And hopefully I shall be seeing you soon.
Indeed, indeed. I appreciate it, Keith. Thank you for joining us once again. I will include as many links and notes in the show notes as I possibly can, so listeners can look you up, find the online shooting school, and maybe book a lesson. But thanks again, my friend. We will be in touch, and I appreciate you.
Thank you very much, mate. Stay safe, keep the family safe, and keep shooting.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.